Ideas Podcast.
The Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast with two siblings who love books.
Yeah, and we even read books without holograms in them.
Yeah,
that's how much we like
books. That's right. We'll go old school. Text only. I don't even need pictures.
Yeah, fuck that. We think books are apocalyptic.
Apocalyptic?
This book was kind of necrotic, but not in the sense of the slang used in the book.
It was kind of literally necrotic.
Yeah, exactly.
Down the stretch there.
So, I'm Gabs.
I'm Ben.
And this week we read Doomsday Book by Connie Willis.
Connie Willis, one of the grand masters of science fiction who most people have never heard of.
Yeah, when we were looking at information for her, we were surprised that she's won so many awards. And we had never heard of her.
She's won, as of the author bio on my edition of the book.
Which was like a 92, I think.
Yeah, which is the same book you have, even though I bought mine new. That might just be the most recent printing.
Yeah.
But as of that, she had won 6 Nebulas and 6 Hugos, plus a Campbell Award, which is basically the Hugo Rookie of the Year Award. And
which is a lot.
That's a lot. There are a lot of really known and decorated authors who don't even come close to that. So she's obviously really respected in the science fiction community, enough so that they named her a Grand Master, which is essentially like the Science Fiction Writers of America Hall of Fame.
It also makes you sound like a total nerd.
It really,
really does. I'm a Grand Master!
Yeah, but those science fiction folks, I'm sure they're totally into it.
Yeah.
They just, if you follow any of them online, they just revel in their geekery.
Oh, yeah.
They know it. They love it.
So even though the book was published in the 90s, we did think it was appropriate to issue a spoiler warning for this episode because not many people have heard of her and read the book, and that there is some spoiler bombs that happen within the text of the book.
Yeah, and you might want to know about them because I haven't met anyone that I know of who's read this, and I'm going to recommend any of you science fiction folks out there, go out and read this book. It was really good.
Even if you're not into science fiction.
Yeah.
I was recommending it to one of my friends, and she was like, I'm not really a big science fiction person, and I was like, it barely reads like science fiction.
It reads almost more like historical fiction, and then there's a big epidemiology thread, and yeah, so anyway, if you don't want to know the intimate details of the book, now's the time to get out, because
yeah,
we're about to
spoil
the shit out of it, because one, everybody dies, and we will name names. Two, Kibrin did not go back to 1320. She went back to 1348,
right when the plague hit England.
Right, the plague, the bubonic plague, the
yes,
Black Death. The one that famously wiped out half of Europe, even to people who don't know shit about history.
That's what I was gonna say. Even if you don't know anything about history, you have heard of the plague, and you know that it killed a shit ton of people.
You don't even have to go to school to know about the Black Death. You
yeah,
could live under a rock on a deserted island, and you'd probably have somehow picked up there was such a thing.
In addition to Game of Thrones, you would know that there was the Black Death. The
and
two
if,
things you would know.
And if any of my friends walk up to me this week and tell me they've never heard of the Black Death, I am going to slap them.
Like that Batman comic of him slapping Robin in the face.
Yes.
Ben, I've never heard of that. Shut up! Slap him.
Memes.
Right before we get started, we did want to mention that we didn't really have any listener response. But I got on iTunes just to see if anyone had dropped us a comment off there, since I haven't checked it in a couple weeks. And someone gave us a 1-star.
Finally,
on
we keep asking people to give us ratings.
Like, I know, and we've been like eagerly awaiting getting flames for like a year now, and no one's given us
one. One of our categories on our outline is really entertaining hate mail.
Yeah, we were expecting to get a ton of it. I mean, as Ben said, we're not really like shy about our social and political views, so we're not really surprised that someone could find something to hate about us.
Yeah, we don't know if they just think we're a bunch of commie leftists bastards, or if they honestly like listened to 20 minutes of it and went, I can't stand these people's personalities.
Yeah, like, and usually when someone hates something enough to give you, like, because we had someone else gave us 2 stars, which is like a, I don't like this, but not necessarily like a raging, boiling hate.
Right.
And 1 star is usually accompanied by, like, a, your podcast is the worst thing in the world.
I know, I'm disappointed by the lack of review with that 1 star rating.
We either wanted to laugh because they were crazy, or be like, oh, they actually made a legitimate point. Let's try to make our podcast better.
Yes, I'll accept constructive criticism, even if it's accidental constructive criticism veiled by internet raging hatred.
Yeah, so if for some reason you're still listening to us, and you're the one who gave us 1 star, let us know why. Or if you just listen and you have an idea why someone might have given us 1 star, let us know why. Like, we won't be mad, we're just curious. Because we don't necessarily think we're worth 5 stars.
Yeah, this is totally a vanity project.
Yeah, even if you hate us, I mean, we're not going to stop. Anyway, I just wanted to point that out. And now I guess we'll get back into talking about Doomsday Book.
Yes, indeed. So we actually kind of went through the next chunk of this.
Yeah. So as we were saying, we picked the book because she's a female science fiction author, which seems to be more rare.
Which is, yeah, comparatively rare. Though getting less so as the years go by.
Yeah, and she's a highly decorated one.
Even more rare.
And, you know, when we read Foundation and Childhood's End and all that, and I was pointing out, there are no freaking women in these books!
Right, all the old school grandmasters seem to have forgotten that women were also human beings. Yeah.
So it was really refreshing reading a book that, you know, won a Nebula Award that's cast is 50% or more of women.
Yeah.
That was very nice. Yeah. I appreciated it. And I liked it better than Foundation or Childhood's End as well. But
yeah, that's fair.
We'll worry about that later. So yeah, as we said, it's technically science fiction, although it kind of reads as historical fiction, and we guessed pretty much the reason it classifies as science fiction is because there's time travel involved.
Yeah, it is in the time travel subgenre, kind of.
And it is set in the future.
Yes.
Which is a science fiction thing.
It's set in 2054, which was even farther in the future when the book was written than it is now.
Really?
Callie.
Really, Cat. We even ran away from her this time, so we wouldn't have to exile her, but apparently not good enough.
I guess.
So, plot synopsis.
Everybody dies. Oh, also time travel.
And when we say everybody dies, in, because there are two settings. We said there's the 2054 setting and there's the 1348 setting, which you don't know. It's 1348 until toward the end of the book. In the 1348 setting, literally everyone dies.
Every person who originated in the 14th century dies. Every single one.
Every single person.
And when the 21st century people are walking around there at the end, they do not come across a single living person.
Yeah, which is why the...
Ooh. Yeah.
It's rough. Real rough.
It is. I was sad.
Also, the descriptions of the deaths were horrible.
Yeah, dying of bubonic plague sounds real shitty, guys.
Yeah. Take a moment and thank modern medicine, because getting giant baseball-sized pus blisters and you're growing an armpit that split open and ooze everywhere while your skin literally necrotizes and turns black and you vomit blood everywhere?
Sounds pretty horrible.
Yeah, and you linger, too. Like, the clerk, the first case of it lasts for, like, a week. Yeah. And by the time he dies, his entire body is just, like, rotten from the inside out.
Everyone else was dying pretty fast, but that clerk just lingered.
Yeah, it was bad.
So, go hit Wikipedia and research the bubonic plague.
And thank God you don't live in the Middle Ages. So, we're going to go ahead and give... What the hell was that?
Someone's beating a gong while the cat meows.
A ghost in our basement.
This is an amazing recording studio.
Guys, maybe that's why we got one star. Our recording professionalism is admittedly terrible.
To be fair, the only thing worse than our studio soundproofing is my audio editing skills.
Anyway, a brief summary. So, Kivrin, who, I don't know why her name is Kivrin, but she's an historical student. This book is actually set in a time where historians are the ones who use time travel to go back and research their areas of interest, which I thought was awesome.
This is way cooler than, like, Time Cops or something.
Yeah, yeah. Way cooler. And so she's a student of the Middle Ages, and previously no one had been allowed to go back there because it was rated a 10 on a danger scale from 1 to 10.
Presumably of 1 to 10.
Yeah. But when the head of the department leaves, he puts another guy in charge who decides, no, we need to go back there. So he sends Kivrin back in time, and the same day that she gets sent back, this fever breaks out in the modern day, and the first guy to get it is one of the techs who is working in the time travel situation, and something's gone wrong with dropping her off in the past, but he's too delirious and sick to be able to say why. He just says something's wrong. And so in the present day, everyone's falling sick of the flu. Mr. Dunworthy, who's a professor of history, is trying to figure out where the flu came from and how to get Kivrin back. And then at the same time, Kivrin's back in the Middle Ages with the same flu everyone else has in the present day. She recovers and kind of gets in with the family, and then everyone dies of the plague.
Yay!
Essentially. More or less. So, when we discussed the Night Circus, we were talking about how we couldn't really pick one protagonist because Marco and Celia were both, like, so important to the plot of the book. And so for this book, we were also trying to pinpoint one protagonist, but because the two storylines are so...
they're so separated.
Yeah, I mean, they're kind of the same because they're both trying to get back to each other, but yeah, I mean, they're separated by 700 years.
Right, you really have two distinct storylines of approximately equal page count with two separate characters as the star of those two storylines that only intertwine very briefly at the beginning and the end.
Yep. So Ben and I decided we're going to go ahead and give this book a co-protagonist designation as well.
Yeah, we're actually going to start doing this for every book because we're lazy. No.
Next week when we read Emma and her friend Harriet are both the protagonists. The following week we'll read Moby Dick. Well, I guess you'd argue that the whale is a co-protagonist of Moby Dick.
Moby and Dick are the co-protagonists. God. I haven't read Moby
Dick,
by the way.
I should not have opened that up. Crime and Punishment. Crime and Punishment. Just Pride and Prejudice. I know we already read it, but...
it turns out Pride is a protagonist and Prejudice is also a protagonist.
Jesus. Okay, well, anyway. In this book, Doomsday and Book are not the co-protagonists.
Doomsday Book.
So in the present day, we have Mr. Dunworthy, who I mentioned is a professor of history. And he's technically a 20th century guy.
Yeah,
is that what he says?
I think so.
Because he's actually been back to the 20th century, but he's studied the Middle Ages.
Right.
Because Kivrin, who's the protagonist of the 1348 plot line, comes to him for help when she's trying to research enough before she goes back there.
Yeah, and he gives her a lot of good advice that doesn't all turn out to be as helpful as it could have been.
Yeah.
But that's more the fault of there being 700 years in between the respective dates, so some of the information, like how Middle English was actually pronounced,
that
purely conjecture.
Yeah, what I was gonna mention is that was actually one of my favorite parts, was everything that she had carefully studied and gotten down to a T and how it was all wrong.
Right,
like,
yeah.
She had learned this language and could not understand a damn word anyone was saying. even though she had learned the language.
Yeah.
Because they pronounced it completely differently.
And they had no idea what she was saying, for that matter, except the church Latin, which, of course, has been preserved.
Yeah, more or less.
Yeah, largely, and it's probably, probably largely in its original form, honestly, even though Latin scholars will tell you that it's been bastardized from, vernacular Latin.
Yes, classical Latin.
Yes.
The Latin the Romans spoke and the Latin the church speaks are very different.
Yes.
Pronunciation-wise.
Yes. Actually, it kind of interested me, I know this is a mild tangent, but going back to the Middle Ages and that language issue, I was kind of thinking that would be a plot point if someone went back to Rome. And I also want to read a book now where someone goes back to Rome.
Oh, yeah.
Because I am fascinated by ancient Rome.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, so she was lucky she had a translator that was sophisticated enough to pick up on the language after it had heard enough words.
Right, yeah.
It was able to figure out the structure and the...
It's like, oh, this is actually the language that I have been programmed with, but it didn't sound like it was supposed to.
Yeah, and I didn't bother to look this up because, you know, our research standards are not very high. But I'm guessing that any time someone from the past was speaking, and it wasn't translated when it was in the italics, that's actually how the Middle English would look.
Mm-hmm.
Probably.
The book seemed pretty well researched overall.
So, but I did like that point, and, you know, historians always say, well, this is our best guess, but if you actually do go back, like, oh, there aren't chimneys, oh, there isn't glass, they're still doing wax linens, mm-hmm. You know, here's the way the farming works. This town, village, whatever she stumbles upon to, has a church and, like, a manor house, but the manor house is way crappier than she expected, and her clothes are way finer than these people who are...
Minor nobility.
Yeah. Even though they made sure to hand weave her cloak and dye it with natural mm-hmm. means, that it was still too good. And I just thought that was... I like that aspect of, oh shit.
Yeah.
Historians don't know everything.
I kind of like that... I mean, I like that element of it a lot as well. I just... Again, the book seemed like it was well-researched. It was interesting. I felt like I was learning some things. I have no idea if they're academically accurate or not.
But... I mean, I'm not a Middle Ages expert by any means, but it all felt pretty authentic. Mm-hmm. I was telling Ben, because I read Timeline in the fall, and at the very beginning of the Doomsday book, I thought that I might catch some parallels between the two, since both of them are about people going back to the Middle Ages, but... Timeline takes a different tact and is more of action adventure set in the 1300s.
Right, it's a thriller.
But he does some of the same stuff, like, oh, here's something we thought was a thing in the past, but it's really this way.
Right. I thought I liked also the idea of historians going back to the past and, you know, going back to that danger scale. And, you know, a lot of the events we learn do tend to be the dangerous ones, oh, the plague or wartime or that kind of stuff, and the idea of avoiding that and really just trying to figure out what the culture and the language and the living conditions were really like, mm-hmm. and how much more useful that actually would be to understanding that time period.
Yeah.
Like, it's really fascinating to me, just in kind of in the abstract, I guess.
That's why they tried to send her to 1320 instead.
Right, yeah.
At a relatively peaceful, non-plaguey time.
And I'm sure even with the plague and all the nasty stuff that ends up happening, and that she was out of commission for several days with that flu, but, I mean, she's still bringing back a wealth of information.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, dang, that would be really exciting if you were a historian.
Oh my gosh, yeah, I was having a nerd guess. Yeah. I was like, I want to do that! That'd be so cool!
So, yeah, Dunworthy.
Oh, right.
He's a worrier.
Mr. Dunworthy.
He's very worried about his student being in the past, especially because of his kind of hilarious antipathy towards Mr. Gilchrist, who he does not trust in the least.
Yeah. Mr. Dunworthy's basically looking for any excuse not to send Kivrin back.
Yes.
And he thinks Mr. Gilchrist is a total idiot. He's the guy who's running the whole show and is just... I always thought he was kind of hilariously over the top of, like, you're going to run into a cutthroat. They're going to burn you at the stake. Yes. They're going to hang you. They're going to... Oh, my God.
And then when she's gone, he's still thinking those things. So it's like, that's authentically inhabiting him. He's not just... exaggerating to try to scare her out of it.
He like keeps thinking, oh god, she's burning at the stake. Someone found her and is killing her. I was like, okay, I know it was medieval times, but it wasn't that bad, I'm sure.
Right, if you just, on average, died every time you walked down the road, we never would have made it to the 21st century.
But he's also capable. He's not just like, worrywart man, because once... everything in the present day kind of starts falling to shit when everyone's catching the flu and they have a quarantine set up around the town, and he's pretty pivotal in trying to figure out like the origin of the flu and where it came from, and
getting
information out of people, and
smart and stubborn and systematic, and he does it. And
very professorly.
And it's not even his area of expertise. He's just very mentally organized.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole time having to do it while fending off various annoying characters. And he's supposed to be... like, sounds like he's more or less running his own college.
Yeah.
Because it's Christmas vacation and no one's around.
And that was... one of the things that I'm sure having a knowledge of how universities in England would help, but I was under the impression that it was like he and Gilchrist were two different colleges, but they were under the same university umbrella.
That was also my impression.
And they were definitely from two different history departments, so I'm not really sure exactly how that works, but they were like independent, but also not...
right.
But he's basically running, like, his corner of the university with his assistant Finch's help.
Yes.
And, yeah, he's just a really capable dude.
And then Kivrin, our other protagonist, is young, a little bit, a little headstrong, perhaps. It's a word you use for a young person,
yeah.
Right? And... impulsive is probably not really the right word, but she's decided she wants to go to the Middle Ages and she's going to make it there come hell or high water.
Yep.
No matter how dangerous people and unpleasant people tell her that it's going to be. And she gets there, so clearly she's good at bending people to her will when she needs to, and they imply that that is kind of the case anyway. And then when she gets there, she does a pretty good job of blending in, though the ignorance of the people there helps a little bit with that.
Yeah. And once she recovers from her illness, especially, she goes, okay, I'll be the children's nurse.
Right, yeah.
And then as long as she's keeping them out of their hair, then...
they're okay with it. They actually seem pretty relieved to have her there, because the girl who was supposed to be watching them was fairly worthless.
Yeah.
And she's, one of the things that struck me about her character is how, emotional she was, despite knowing she was there to study things and, like, really only having known these people for a handful of days, just how deeply she was attached to them.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, some of the stuff that happened while she was feverish, okay, like... she was openly referencing where she came from and such. And I was going, boy, that must be a nasty fever, because I just can't...
imagine.
Yeah, I've never been that out of control in my life, but I've also never had a high fever for several days in a row.
Yeah, I've never been sick to the point of delirium.
Yeah.
So.
But man, just watching the whole village die around her pretty much destroys her. And, I mean, to be fair, I'm not saying that I would shrug that off and be like, whatever, I can watch a whole village full of people die. No big deal. At least I hope not.
That's what I'd say. Like, even...
that would imply bad things.
Even if you've only known them for a week, like, watching everyone die horribly would be pretty tough.
It would be really upsetting at the least. But, I mean, she's barely functional when they find her. Though, again, to her credit, she's pretty tough because she pulls it together enough that by the time they get back to their drop point, she's helping Dunworthy, who's recovering from a nasty flu.
That he almost died of.
That he almost died of, yeah.
I was really hoping when she realized the plague and trying to, like, spread, you know, germ knowledge of don't touch a sick person and all that stuff, I was really hoping she was going to save, like, one person.
I know. I thought that she was going to manage to do it, but, you know, the plague is nasty and contagious. What was it? One of the numbers that got thrown around when someone was talking about the plague in the 21st century was a 91% morbidity rate.
Yeah.
That means if you have contact with that person, you are almost certainly going to get sick.
Uh-huh.
And without modern medicine, that means I don't know what the mortality rate is on the bubonic plague, but obviously it's close to 100%.
Yeah, and she was thinking, you know, oh, Mr. Gilchrist thought it might be half to a third of people will even get it. And then that ended up being totally wrong, but...
sounds like the places where, I mean, I have to read up on it. That's definitely one thing that I want to do after having read this. So I want to read up on the plague a little bit. But it sounds like that any city where it hit was pretty much wiped out. It was basically like The Stand.
Yeah. Yeah, actually.
And the places, like the half of Europe that didn't die was the half where the illness never made it into those cities and towns, like, and
Poland
farms.
Poland and Scotland and stuff.
Oh, man.
they were okay.
So let's do a quick character roll call here.
We have Dr. Ahrens
works for me.
She inoculated Kivrin against various diseases and all that junk before she went back. And she's actually there when, Bodri, the first guy to get sick, gets sick and is in charge of the whole quarantine and trying to figure out a vaccine and taking care of people and stuff. So she's just, like, the head doctor of this hospital, I guess.
Yeah, and if Dunworthy is the stand-in worrying father, then she's kind of the stand-in worrying mother for Kivrin. Not quite to the same degree, but she was definitely on the good guy's side, so to speak.
I liked how she started the book kind of goofy, like talking about Christmas shopping and how much she hated the bells.
Right.
And like worrying about her great nephew Colin, and then the disease hits and she's immediately like full out doctor mode. Yeah,
kicks into professional mode.
Yeah, like drops her bag of shopping and is like, let's do this.
And killed off while Dunworthy's unconscious.
Not very cool. They're just like, oh yeah, by the way, she died.
We didn't even know she was sick. He woke up and she's gone.
And I mean, I was surprised it took her and Dunworthy so long to get sick, because both of them were basically awake for 72 hours straight.
Yeah.
And compromising your sleep schedule and stuff can't be good for getting sick.
No.
But, yeah, that sucked. I was pretty upset.
Yeah.
That she died off.
And then her great-nephew, Colin.
He's the stand-in teenager.
Yeah, he's not even...
He's like 12.
He's like 12, but he's tall for his age.
He was pretty funny, though.
He was pretty funny. He was awfully useful, as it turns out, though.
Yeah, like, because at first you're just like, oh, like, it's, you know, the smart-ass 12-year-old character, but no, he is actually, like, useful and interested in being useful. And,
and those elements stayed in there. I mean, like, he's running messages and helping to count supplies and doing stuff that needs to be done. But at the same time, he's doing it, like, with his jacket unsealed and, like, making fun of the ugly scarf that is...
in the muffler. The muffler's gonna keep the flu away.
Yeah, that's right. he's pretty entertaining. And he introduced us to our favorite new slang terms.
Apocalyptic.
And necrotic.
Apocalyptic is good.
Necrotic seems to be bad. And he also called Mrs. Gadsden the gallstone.
The gallstone. But I also think Colin was just, like, after someone who actually, like, paid any attention to him.
He was clearly starving for that.
Because his mother is apparently a bad mom. And,
she gives no shits about him whatsoever. And it doesn't seem to be just through the eyes of Dr. Ahrens. It seems to be pretty well borne out by evidence.
Yeah, she just sends him off. She finds that he went through the quarantine.
She sends him off for Christmas.
Yeah. She wants to hang with her boyfriend.
Yeah, her live-in.
Her live-in. And then Mr. Dunworthy gives him, like, some candy and a book on the Crusades or the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
For Christmas. And that's, like, the best he can find at the last minute. And then Colin's like, this is the best Christmas I've ever had.
It's like, oh boy.
It's like, oh, you poor child.
Poor Colin. He was fascinated by that Middle Ages book.
Yeah. I liked Colin. He was not, like, he was not annoying.
Yeah.
You have Montoya, who is an American archaeologist doing a dig in England, and she's actually the one who brings the flu, upon everyone because she and Baudry, crack open a tomb at the site she's excavating, and...
Yep. Turns out virus spores hanging out in the tomb with a 14th century variant of the flu, which, not surprisingly, our immune system's not adjusted to.
Yeah.
Also, the plausibility of that was explained within the body of the novel. I buy it. They claim to have found living ones on mummies. They're older than 700 years.
And they said that mummies have gotten people sick.
There you go.
So, and if it was sealed, if he was sealed away when he was still fresh, then I'd say it's possible.
I can deal with it.
But yeah, her main character trait was just obsessed with going back to her dig.
Yeah. Though, like, her one kind of redeeming moment, though rather morbid, was she was going through all of the human remains they'd uncovered and trying to find the recorder on the wrist bone in case Kivrin had died so they could at least figure out what happened.
Yeah, so Kivrin records everything. And they couldn't just give her a recorder because the people of the Middle Ages would be like, what is that devilry?
Right, walking around like our digital recorder here. Yeah. Like, could you speak into this, please?
Yeah. So they give her a little quarter implant that is supposed to look like a bone spur on her wrist.
Mm.
And so Montoya's looking at all the wrist bones, trying to find one with the spur on it to make sure that none of them are Kivrin.
So she does care. She's just obsessed with her dig, mostly.
Yeah.
Baudry is the tech, apparently the best one around. Though, had trouble setting the appropriate date through his fever delirium.
Yeah. Way to go.
Poor dude was about as sick as you could possibly get without dying of it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I thought for sure he was gonna die.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's basically his...
Yeah, he was... just, like, the delirious guy. That's really his character trait.
Well, and then when he finally recovered, and he's like, didn't you figure it out? What are you talking about? Kivrin's in 1348.
Oh, shit.
And they're like, oh, god damn it!
I knew it!
Because one of the huge problems in this book is that Dunworthy is, like, struggling to find a tech to read the drop coordinates since Baudry's sick.
They're all on Christmas vacation.
And then Gilchrist shuts the lab off, and he can't get back in, and then he turns it off, and he's like, now we don't even have anything, and then Baudry's like, oh, I had a backup right here. And if this had happened in, like, October, the problem would have been taken care of very quickly.
Immediately. Well, yeah. She never would have gone to the wrong place if that flu hadn't come out.
Yeah.
So, Gilchrist, we already touched on a little bit. He's the temporary head of the college. He's, the Gung one who Ho. Wants her to go back and is just kind of an all-around officious idiot.
Yeah.
He's, I'm in charge, I'm running things, and we have to prove that our department is awesome and that I'm awesome, and I won't do anything without the head of the department who is on vacation overriding me directly. And who knows where he is. Yeah, he's supposedly in Scotland, and No, they call like every single place in Scotland where he could possibly be and can't find him.
Even his wife doesn't know where he is.
Yeah, I know. I had a theory. I actually thought he was back. I thought he was in Scotland, but that he'd gone back in time. He could like fish in 1815 so Scotland or something.
No one could get it.
Yes.
And that. Oh, there's something else I wanted to say about Gilchrist. Oh, he was also, like, kind of an idiot in the way that he didn't entirely seem to understand time travel, because he was all freaked out about, the plague or, like, a flu coming back from the past, and didn't understand the physics, which they don't ever explain in detail, but the physics of time travel apparently is that it has, like, an anti-paradox thing already set up. So if you're trying to send a historian back in time, and it's gonna mess with the timeline at all and screw up the present, then it won't let you go back in time. And if you have like an illness that you could give to the people, then you can't go back. Or anything from the past that's dangerous can't come to the present. So there's like a complete seal off there.
Yeah, and it's just another illumination of how clueless he is, because he's trying to be in charge of this time travel operation that he's sounds like kind of thrown together at the last second.
Yeah.
And he doesn't really understand any of the technical aspects of it, and he doesn't really seem to understand the severity of Kivrin's potential situation or care.
Yeah.
And doesn't really seem to he finally figures out how severe the 21st century epidemic is, but then freaks out and completely overreacts to it.
Mm-hmm.
Just.
And then he just conveniently dies.
Yeah, they kill him off. That's what he gets for being a jerk. The author decided to kill him off.
She killed off all the good characters, so I guess she decided she tend to kill off one that we didn't like.
That's right. It was William Gadsden.
Kill off Gadsden's mom, jeez.
I know, she was obnoxious. She's. Okay, so she's the cliche, super overbearing mother,
mm-hmm.
talking about how her William's going to get ill, even though he's apparently built like a linebacker.
Yeah.
And, like, the healthiest person in Oxford.
Incredibly heavy, healthy.
And is running around during this epidemic reading, like, all of the pestilence passages of the Bible at people.
Yeah, she's in the hospital reading the Bible to people, so you'd think, like, oh, that's really nice. She's reading, like, soothing passages to patients who are ill, but she's reading, like, God sends a plague upon you for being sinful.
We are sinners. He will strike us
down. Yeah, I was like, that is rude.
What is wrong with you? Meanwhile, William apparently has every student-aged woman in Oxford wrapped around his little finger.
Yeah, every single 20-something woman that Dunworthy meets has been involved with William at some point.
That was a kind of hilarious running joke.
Yeah, it was. And actually liked how it carried throughout the entire novel and then actually worked to their benefit at the end.
They end up scrounging up their crew of folks to send them back through the net to rescue Kivrin entirely through people that William has apparently made out with.
Yeah. I thought that was awesome. Oh, also, this guy's apparently so healthy. He was, according to Dunworthy, you know, making out with basically any woman who hadn't gotten sick yet. And, you know, then they would get the flu, like, the next day or whatever. He was just totally fine the entire time.
And he was useful in other ways, too. Like, there were a couple of instances where Dunworthy said, hey, go hunt this down for me. And he, like, somehow in between running all over the city, avoiding his mother, making out with various women, like, assembles, like, collates this really detailed list of hard-to-find information in his spare time.
Yeah.
It's like, William's kind of the man.
Maybe he actually was reading Plutarch.
Yeah, maybe he was.
Yeah, and I liked the threat of, go do this for me, or I'm putting your mom up in your room.
Yeah.
He's like, oh shit, he's like, no.
Oh boy, he's like, I don't want to deal with her either.
I'll go do that.
Dunworthy's faithful assistant, Finch, who is really pedantic.
He's super worried they're running a laboratory paper.
Yeah, he's really worried about the supplies. He doesn't have a ton of initiative, though. He does kind of seem to figure those things out when Dunworthy pretty much cuts him off.
Yeah.
He seems to be a pretty decent assistant if you can handle his constantly needing to update you on things you don't care about.
Yeah. And he apparently knows how to ring a bell.
Yeah, he filled in for the bells, the bell ringers.
So.
And then there's our 14th century cast.
Yeah, so Kevrin gets picked up by a family that's, like we said, minor nobility. And the father is not there. And I think there are like three sons, too, that aren't there.
Yeah.
And they mention that he's off in Bath doing part of a... testifying at a trial.
Right.
So we just have his wife, Eloise, his mother, Emain, and then the two daughters, Agnes and Rosamond, and then the worthless servant girl, Maisery. So it's basically a entirely female household. Yeah. Right now, holding down fort.
With one man-at-arms to keep an eye on things.
Yeah, Gawain.
He seems to be an all-around... he seems to be a bodyguard and wannabe adventurer type.
Yeah, he's bragging about killing wolves in the woods and hunting down Kivrin's attackers. And basically... But, I mean, he's not worthless, because Emain, the mother, slash mother-in-law... says, you know, go do this, and he'll go off and do it.
Like, oh, yeah, like...
traveling to other towns and carrying messages.
He gets the remains of a wagon... A bust... He gets, like, every shard of wood from a busted-up wagon and all the stuff inside of it from a couple miles away back to the manor. That's pretty efficient for one guy.
Yeah.
And they seem... He's definitely a trusted...
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, like, servant doesn't seem like quite the right term, but...
Man-at-arms?
Man-at-arms, waiting, I don't know.
I guess it would depend if the lord of the household, like, what his title is.
Right, yeah.
If he's, like, a duke or a knight. So.
Right. He'd be, like, when you think of the knights for a king's court, he'd be like the equivalent of that for this minor noble, I guess.
Yes. And his big thing is he's in love with Eloise, who's the lady of the household, and is essentially doing all this stuff to try and impress her.
Yes. And it seems implied that it's mutual, or at least mutual enough that Emain has her suspicions.
Yeah, because Kivra notices it, and she's thinking, like, oh, this guy's just totally in love with her, and then she starts thinking, like, oh, maybe Elvis kind of likes him back, but isn't doing anything about
she's
it.
She's too nervous to do anything in their current setting.
And then at the end, when Emain is accusing everyone of bringing the plague upon them, she says, you being an adulteress, ruining everything. Babe, you kind of have that aspect Ben brought up, a little reminiscent of courtly love, where, like, the knight loves this maiden or married woman or whatever and goes out and does a ton of stuff for her without ever necessarily expecting, like, any physical payoff for it, just to get her affection in return.
Yes.
Whatever. And when you study the past, or, like, the Middle Ages times, you know, everyone just expected to get married off to whoever. So you found your love through courtly love. And it didn't involve, like, any of the sex or anything, but, like, since you were probably married to some person you didn't give a shit about, like, you got all your emotional fulfillment through courtly love, and then you did all the other stuff through your husband, so. It's kind of... Yeah, how that works.
Yeah.
And then the daughters, Agnes and Rosamond. Agnes is, like, six...
Yeah, she's 5 or 6.
And Rosamond's 12.
Yeah. Rosamond we don't see as much as... we see her be upset when her betrothed shows up for a while.
40-year-old super fat dude.
Yeah. He didn't seem to be that terrible by the standards of what terrible could potentially be, but he certainly was a... fat creeper.
Yeah, Ben and I are having this conversation of, like, you know, in a society where you girls get married off at 12 and 13, if you're an adult man getting married to a 12-year-old and you, like, give her a kiss and, like, pinch her butt or whatever, and you're like, but you're getting married in 3 months, like, people aren't going to really necessarily think that's creepy. Like, I can understand why Rosamund's horrified and hates it.
Right.
Because if you're a 12-year-old, probably not even interested in getting married, let alone to, like, an old fat guy.
Right.
And
I'm sure if you're a noble's daughter, you're hoping to be married off to a handsome noble's son who will at least be nice to you.
Yeah, I mean, Lord Blout did at least seem like he'd be nice to her.
Yeah, I mean, he
didn't seem like a
he was bringing guy. Gifts. He seemed friendly, though he definitely came across as a man's man.
Yeah, which, you know.
Which, you know, 14th century, there were no sensitive 21st century men.
Right. But Kivrin did point out that there were husbands who did much worse things to their wives.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, could be worse, I guess.
Yeah.
But when you're 12, I guess, nothing really seems worse than that.
Agnes is just a young child.
Yeah.
She's bouncing all over the place.
She's pretty cute. Her main function is that she has no filter and, like, doesn't realize if something's a secret.
Right.
And so she just talks and talks and talks, and Kivrin gets to pick up on a lot of the context from all the crap that Agnes says.
She's very convincingly a mildly spoiled, rambunctious young kid.
Yeah. Yeah. And her doggie, Blackie.
Blackie.
Her hound that dies.
Dies of rough handling.
Yeah, the kids are just, like, over-loving him.
Like, we're doggie!
Pass him around!
Swing, spin, throw, squeeze. Oh, boy.
Puppy dead.
Poor puppy.
And shoot.
Father Roche. Unless you were about to make another point.
I feel like it was, but I don't know what it was, so you can keep going. So Father Roche is the clergyman.
He's a strong type, physically, yeah, emotionally.
He's apparently super tall and, like, just, like, a big guy.
Yeah. Looks kind of scary.
Yeah, Kivrin thinks he's a bad guy at first because he looks scary, but he turns out to be nice. He's kind of the typical country priest who can, like, say the Latin Mass but can't actually read it.
Right.
And, like, knows how to do the basic stuff, but can't really do the pomp and circumstance.
Right.
He's educated in...
He fulfills the important functions of his office, but he's not educated enough to be great at the ceremonial functions of his office. Like, when people are sick, when, you know, something needs to be... When someone needs to be prayed over or treated or nursed, he's right there, and he's very kind and very gentle and very devoted and apparently does a great job.
But, yeah.
You know, a main is hung up on his being undereducated.
Country folk.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I liked the contrast. You have Father Roche, who's this, like, poor country priest who doesn't really know what he's doing all the time. He forgets some of the words to Christmas Mass. But is just really caring and compassionate and, you know, gives his all to the people in around where he is. And then you have the bishop and the other higher-up church officials with their, like, super fine clothing and they're drinking constantly and obviously not following their vow of chastity.
Feeling out the serving girls.
Yeah. And they can do all the pomp and circumstance stuff, but then they're gonna, like, get the hell out of town when shit hits the fan.
Yeah. And Roche was, I mean, he was kind of the guy who convinced, I mean, the family did to a degree as well, but he's kind of the one who convinced Kivrin that they're good people in all ages.
Uh-huh.
And that the Middle Ages aren't actually horrible. Though it did take me a little while to get fully on board with him, because he was the strong, silent type for, like, the first half of the book. Because she kept coming up to him and trying to talk to him, like, he wouldn't say anything for a long time. It was a little weird.
Yeah, though you do find out at the end that he actually just watched Kivrin appear.
Yeah.
And so that's why he thinks she's a saint.
Right.
He was a little awestruck, it turns out.
So that's probably why he was being kind of weird around her.
It's like, you were sent from heaven. It's like, oh, good. It's a good thing he saw her and not somebody thought she was a witch.
Yeah, exactly. Moving on to issues, we already talked a little bit about Rosamund's engagement. One thing Ben and I both noted was that the main female character in the book is the one who's going back to the Middle Ages. And the Middle Ages is not a time known for treating its women well.
It seems like she would have had a lot of trouble moving around freely and having... I mean, I guess if you're just there to kind of be in the background and observe, maybe it makes more sense in some ways. But the fact that they come up with this ruse with the broken up wagon and the mild head wound and the...
And she was attacked in her servant's flood.
It just seems... Yeah, I mean, it seems like if you go to that much trouble just to be allowed to move freely for a couple of weeks, that maybe it's not a great time for you to go back to.
Yeah, I was thinking she was actually kind of lucky that she was sick, because then someone would take her in and nurse her back to health instead of being like, who are you? What are you doing here? Kind of thing.
I'm the daughter of some noble you've never heard of. See my nice dress? In the religious and spiritual realm, I mean, talked about Father Roche a little bit already. He's very devoted. He seems to be a true believer. Mm-hmm. But we didn't really see a lot of what the peasants were doing, but the nobility did not seem to be as much true believers. They went through all the motions. It's almost, you know, going back to the Rome reference again, like where the religious ceremonies were really important to them, but it wasn't really a personal thing.
Connection, yeah.
So, like, yeah, we fast until after midnight mass on Christmas, and we go, do all the stuff.
Yeah, and it means pissed if, like, the ceremony's wrong in any way.
Right, but they're not on their knees praying all the time, like, for people who are in trouble and such, which Roche is definitely doing.
And one of the things that you talk about history-wise for the Middle Ages is that, you know, God and angels were a way bigger presence, and that people, you know, Roche can actually believe that she's a saint from heaven because the supernatural seemed closer to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of people, you know, have conjecture that religion is going to be really super important to them, that they're going to be talking about it a lot and praying a lot, and you have, like, your cross in you at all times or whatever. And Kirkman kind of notes that doesn't really seem to be the case.
Yeah, they kind of go on with their day-to-day life like people kind of have to do.
Yeah.
Even though there's matins and vespers and...
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Father Roche is doing way more stuff at the church than you picture most priests doing these days, mm-hmm. at least. Trying to figure out what the theme of this book might be, and it seemed to me... Because the last scene was them stepping into the net together, kind of like this little family unit almost. That the family ties thing was one of the themes. Maybe the big one. Probably the big one. Because Dunworthy definitely seems to be kind of a father figure to Kivrin. They both seem to think of it that way a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
He kind of adopts Colin,
mm-hmm.
whose family situation is crappy.
But he does adopt Colin.
I know. Kind of finds a good situation, especially for all the chaos and the fact that he's trapped there for extra time. And Dunworthy and Colin going back and rescuing Kivrin. It's almost like dad and his daughter and son stepping back into the future from the 14th century at the end there. Dad to go into the rescue there. And then also just Kivrin being part of the family unit. Because, I mean, Colin and Dunworthy kind of had their family, mini family unit they forged in the 21st century. And then Kivrin being part of the 14th century household and the children at least bonding with her
mm-hmm.
a pretty fair amount.
Agnes died asking for Kivrin.
Yeah. Now I'm sad again.
Yeah. It sucked. Yeah, so the importance of family ties and caring about people and all that. One of the themes we thought was kind of the question or exploration of how helpful Kivrin was to the people in the 1300s.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a thread there. Roche thought that she'd been sent from heaven to help them, and, you know, she was a big help nursing people when the plague was wiping out the entire village.
Yeah, but because...
couldn't save them, literally.
That's what I was gonna say. I think she felt like a huge failure because everyone died.
Mm-hmm. But he thought that she... when he was dying, he seemed to really think that she had accomplished something
and
mentioned that she'd restored his faith.
That's what I was going to say, yeah. It sounded like without her, Roche might have left or despaired. Mm-hmm. Or...
and he made sure everyone was getting their rights and taken care of. So, I mean, from his perspective, spiritually, she did save the entire village.
Mm-hmm.
From her perspective, everybody died mostly pretty horribly, and she failed completely. And Colin did make the comment when he and Dunworthy came through the net to pull her out of there, because they went through another small village first where everybody was just dead.
Like, lying in the streets.
Yeah, and... a couple of, like, before things completely failed, some attempts have been made to bury people, but they couldn't carry them, so they... like, dragged them by their necks into the churchyard.
Yeah. And
he said, you did... yeah, you helped them. You should have seen this other village we were in. And it's like, boy, help is a relative term, I guess.
Yeah, because hers was... everyone was at least properly buried with some kind of ceremony, so...
yeah.
And then another theme I think is talking about a past influence... past influence on the present and the present influence on the past. Assuming that you can't technically influence because of paradox theory. We did have an influenza from the past killing multiple people in the present, and then a force from the present going to the past and giving people comfort. So there's this idea of, like, this interconnectedness, even if they're not technically allowed to interconnect.
Right. You can't influence the whole course of history, but you can at least... interact and have some meaningful connections, perhaps.
Yeah.
All right, so some points of interest. We referenced Blackie. There was also this cow.
Oh my gosh, this poor cow. So, you know, if you don't milk a cow for a long time, it's in pain because it's all swollen. And so Kivrin milks this cow, like, one time while she's nursing everyone. And then, like, for the entire, like, last 50-100 pages of the book, this cow is, like, following her around, like, mooing at her, like... that's bass.
Yes, it is.
Like, milk me! And she's like, get out of here, cow!
It's like, I'm trying to deal with dying people, and this cow is just following her all over the village.
Yeah, and they just leave it there.
Poor cow.
It never gets milk.
And it's, yeah, it's bothering Dunworthy when he shows up.
I was so sad. I was like, milk the cow!
Somebody help that poor cow. So it was only kind of, it was implied more than it was directly stated. They occasionally talked about it, but the way time travel works, we've made a couple references to it too, like, apparently the laws, like, the temporal laws of the universe will not allow paradoxes. And I've always been a fan of the no paradox theory of time travel. But, so, you know, what's already happened has happened. You can't go back and change it. Another thing Gilchrist didn't understand.
Yeah.
Like the rules on things getting through the net.
Mm-hmm.
The music bump today brought to you by Scott Practicing. Did you have anything you wanted to add to how time travel works?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, the cell phone issue.
Yes, there were relatively minor plot points, mostly just waiting for people to call and being worried because there's no one to take messages. Like, he let the bell ringers practice in his private quarters so they could answer the phone for him.
Yeah. And the one futuristic thing about phones in this book is you can see the video of the person when you're talking to them.
Yeah, I forgot to mention that when we were talking about it before we recorded, but, like, every single science fiction writer and screenwriter and futurist thought that we would have video phones someday, and hardly any of them thought we'd all have phones we just carried around with us. The best example I can think of off the top of my head is Star Trek, where they had the little communicators on their chest. Because they could communicate with anybody at any time, but, like, that's one of the only examples.
Yeah, mostly it's just like, you can see the person you're talking to. Yeah!
It's the 23rd century. Let me go answer my bitchin' video phone. I had to leave the house. Take messages for me.
Yeah, exactly. And I was just, like, I was laughing because... Like, if she had written this, you know, 10 years later, everyone would be carrying around a smartphone and, right. Like, Colin would be texting all his friends. I just thought that was...
Yeah.
It dated it a little bit.
Yeah, it was amusing. It didn't affect the plot. If they'd had cell phones, then it would have barely altered what was happening.
They could have still had some of the same problems.
But it was rather amusing to see it. All right, so how about the quality of the writing?
It was well written.
It was well written. I had a couple of notes about characters, and we talked about characters a long time with this book, so clearly there was a lot more characterization going on than the Night Circus. But she did kind of the thing where she assigned each character a distinct trait and then kind of built their personality up around it.
Mm-hmm.
Which for the secondary characters was really useful because you could kind of classify them a little bit.
Yeah.
And for the main characters, the folks who got a lot of page time, it was effective because instead of them being one-dimensional, she just added layers to it.
Yeah.
And then... The other thing was, like, kind of one of my favorite parts of how it was written is kind of one of my least favorite parts at the same time, where, there's kind of this, especially in the 21st century, there's this kind of controlled chaos going on. Everybody is frantic, and everybody is communicating, like, in fragments, and they're not even having the same conversation with each other half the time, and Dunworthy especially is just constantly, like... getting a page of a voice at him from some character, and frequently that character's being really annoying, but they were kind of amusing, and like it kind of like made me feel slightly stressed, but not in a bad way, just kind of like in a way where I felt more like I was in the middle of things, I guess.
And one of the things I was wondering is that I was never bored. But after I did finish the book, because it is, like, 600 pages long, I was thinking about it, and I was like, do we really need all of the Dunworthy investigation? Like, I feel like they rehashed a lot of stuff multiple times, and that maybe that could have been cut down some. Kevin was worrying about the drop a lot. I mean, understandably, but, right. Like, but some of it did get a little repetitive, and maybe... wasn't all necessary, but it never, you know, made me enjoy the book less, so I don't know if that's super important, but...
Yeah, I mean, like, if you're looking to... You know, I guess if you're doing that hip internet thing and looking to nitpick, that's the thing you'd have to choose, but... Overall, it was really well written. It was easy to read.
Yeah.
I read... larger chunks of this at a time than I have our last couple books. Mm-hmm. So a couple of questions here.
Yeah, what happened to the cow?
Poor cow. The boy on the horse who shows up and delivers a message, and then everyone dies of the plague, and then Dunworthy comes back and he finds the horse, like, barely, like, a mile from the village, barely away from it, tangled up in some foliage. And no sign of the boy. I guess he, like, got feverish and fell off the horse somewhere? I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah,
what happened... What about all the characters off-screen? So, we keep hearing about Lord Guillaume and his sons and the trial going on, but you never actually get to meet them? I kept hoping he would show up, but...
I know.
Best guess, he died of the plague. Since everyone else did.
And then a question that I added in shortly after we started recording that I probably edited this part out because there's a lot of silence. But what in the hell happened to Bazengame, the head of the college that Gilchrist kept wanting signatures from?
Yeah, since they spend the entire book looking for him and never find him.
He never shows up. Not even like a 30-second phone call at the end.
Like, oh, hey, guys.
This dude's on vacation. Surely he's seen the news.
He is serious about his vacation.
He is not going to be interrupted. My verdict. I liked it. In case that wasn't obvious, kind of kicked up a lot of curiosity about that time period because it's one that gets covered not as much in history classes, especially if you're not a history major. And also, I really want to read a couple more of her books now because she's clearly a really significant author if you're a science fiction person, which I am.
And if her other books are as good as this one, then worth reading.
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah, I really liked it too. I liked it better than some of the other classic science fiction stuff we've read. It was more engaging and relatable for me.
Yeah.
Except the thing that sucked about it was when everyone died, I was really sad. Like, yeah. I was actually depressed for the rest of the night.
I know. I finished it. I just the last, I don't know, 50 pages-ish, I had to just read, even though I was supposed to be hanging out with Erica.
Oh my gosh, I had to read them, even though I was supposed to be hanging out with Scott.
Okay, she was being phone girl, so...
He was playing Nintendo.
Yeah.
It's fine.
I got to the end, and I'm like, oh, I'm sad now.
Yeah, he went, Gabs, be happy. I was like, I can't, everyone died. It sucks.
Literally everyone. So, what are you reading right now?
St. Lucy's Home for Girls Raised by Wolves. It's a short story collection written by Karen Russell. And it's like short stories that all have one fantastical element. So the short story I just started reading today is a pioneer family traveling west, but their dad is a minotaur and pulling their wagon for them. Stuff like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Kind of fun.
Yeah.
I'm reading Fuzzy Nation by John Scalzi, which is actually a reboot of Get Fuzzy, but I can't remember the author. I don't know. It was kind of like a little fun...
Oh, the comic?
No.
I was like, what?
Like a 1960s science fiction novel.
Okay.
That he loved, obviously, when he was younger. And it's cute. It was very much a fun project for him. He had enough of a name to do it, so he did it. And I'm enjoying it. So, I don't know, maybe I'll go back and read the original and see what the differences are at some point.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's it. So, if you'd like to contact us, you can drop a comment on our website at novelideaspodcast.com.
We're also on Twitter at novelideaspod.
You can email us at novelideaspodcast@gmail.com.
And you can find us on iTunes, leave ratings and reviews. And if you're going to leave one-star ratings, please leave a review.
Tell us why!
So curious!
Coal burning.
So curious. Next week, we are going to be reading Holes by Louis Sacher?
I actually do not know how to pronounce his name.
All right, fair enough.
Man who wrote the Wayside School books and other things, and Holes is a classic.
Also becoming a beloved classic young person's movie, perhaps? Movie wasn't that great.
Movie wasn't that great.
Yeah. Does it have Shia LaBeouf in it?
Yeah, that's why.
No wonder. So I think that does it for this time.
Yep.
And we'll do it again. So see you later.